What's is a Publix a gym?
No, a Publix is a grocery chain in Florida that is well beloved and has good sandwiches as well. It does sandwiches. Oh, I had this realization coming from Europe and the difference between Celsius and Fahrenheit in terms of accurate and efficient measures of weather. If you live in a predominantly cold place, I believe you should go by Celsius because it is more oriented around freezing. And so therefore the vast majority of the time it's going to be on stuff that you care about, which is that difference between 15 degrees, 20 degrees above freezing. So it is very efficient. It is oriented toward that. If you live in a predominantly hot climate, you are more around that 100 degree temperature. And it matters a lot that 20 degrees between 80 degrees and 100. But that is my new thing. I'm not anti-Celsius if you want to use Celsius, but I think it's best used in cold climates and Fahrenheit best used in warm climates.
I like that.
I will endorse that.
Yeah, I like that. That makes a lot of sense. I read somebody one time was talking about like, it's almost like they're designed for different things. Like Kelvin is designed for like molecules. Celsius is designed for water and Fahrenheit is designed for people or something like that. I find them all kind of weird, by the way, because like, I just want to know, is it comfortable to walk around outside? That's all I need to know for weather. Or is stuff going to freeze?
If
you know, those are basically the two things I need to know. Right. So like Fahrenheit's weird. Like where, you know, like 32 is freezing point, then it gets up to 100. Like I would have like 100, like 0 to 100 and 100. Anyway, I'm not going to bother redesigning this. I like your analysis, Justin.
There we go. Hey, we have an email here at the top of the show. We don't normally do this. I drove to Penn State. Sign guy writes, I drove to Penn State for the Michigan game at Big Noon Kickoff. It's Fox's version of College Game Day. And they gave me $25 in a gift card for having one of the 10 best signs that they aired on television that morning, which was Jim Harbaugh can still coach today if Mike Pence has the courage to do it. I just want to honor that listener.
That's
here.
A great sign about a great American, Jim Harbaugh.
From Orlando, Florida, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Redondo Beach, California,
I'm Jennifer Briney.
And from Austin, Texas,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we are going to talk all things George Santos as a ethics committee investigation is revealed that I just have to say is among the best reads that you're going to have this holiday season. Just a delight. We're going to break it down here for you. And then I will do my best to try to explain to Heaton and Jen what happened with OpenAI, the fastest growing startup in tech history, seemingly evaporating overnight, only to rematerialize this morning. All of your questions vis-a-vis Jen and Heaton will be answered. If I don't fall asleep in the middle of this show, not because it's boring, which it might be, but because I am intensely jet lagged. Let's talk about George Santos, huh? The House Ethics Committee's investigation into Representative George Santos of New York revealed several significant findings. The committee discovered that Santos has engaged in a variety of unethical and potentially unlawful activities, including questionable conduct during his 2022 congressional campaign, failure to comply with mandatory financial disclosures, potential violations of federal conflict of interest laws, and allegations of inappropriate behavior toward a prospective employee. Additionally, the investigation revealed that Santos is facing 23 criminal charges in a federal indictment, highlighting a complex pattern of alleged misconduct. Regarding the misuse of campaign funds, the investigation found that Santos frequently, and I say frequently, I mean nearly exclusively, utilized campaign resources for his personal benefit. Notably, substantial amounts of campaign money spent on high-end dinners, travel, transportation services, often justified as expensive for donor or constituent engagement, for which had no underpinning facts to them. More troubling are expenditures that included $2,281.52 at resorts in Atlantic City and $3,332.81 in Airbnb bookings at the Hamptons during a personal trip, as well as taxi and hotel charges in Las Vegas incurred during a period when Santos was, according to his own calendar, on his honeymoon with no corresponding campaign events scheduled. The report has also mentioned expenditures on spa services, cosmetic procedures, raising further questions about the further use of campaign funds. These findings demonstrate a significant deviation from ethical campaign practices and raise serious concern about the misappropriation of these resources. Santos has managed to avoid expulsion thus far. He faced a vote in early November 2023 to be expelled from the House, which he survived, as most Republicans and 31 Democrats chose to withhold punishment until this report is out. Well, the report is out. There's a lot to comb through here. Jen, you already did an episode on it. What sticks out the most in this Santos story? And I'm going to report to you, dear listeners, Heaton is smiling like a butcher's dog, and I can't blame him. This is a delight. Please go ahead, Jen.
I mean, this guy is just a brazen liar. And I guess when I read it, well, there's one thing I do want to clarify, because there were a lot of allegations there that the ethics committee looked into, and he appears to be guilty of most of them. But the ethics committee report did clear him of the one that was like he sexually harassed someone in his office. They said that's the one thing he didn't do.
Because the one guy who says he sexually harassed him seems to be as big of a liar as George Santos. It wasn't that they found that it didn't happen. It was that they found that this guy seemed to be untrustworthy as well.
Yeah, like not credible at all. But the rest of it, I mean, George Santos straight up stole from, like, the craziest part for me is the way he stole from his donors. Like, took a guy's credit card who was, I mean, already not a genius, because this guy was going to give George Santos $5,000 for his campaign. Like, why? And instead, George Santos took that credit card and kept charging stuff over $40,000. And he did this to multiple people. I mean, that's just straight up theft. And then he also, one of the things I ended up marinating on at the end of my episode that I learned through this was a lot of what George Santos did, like lying wise, he was doing, like, he said that he had donated like $800,000 to his campaign, that he was loaning his campaign all of this money. But then finding out after the fact that he was trying to hit these fundraising thresholds that the Republican Party was setting. And they said, well, loans to your own campaign don't count. And he's like, well, God damn it. Now I'm going to have to do this a different way. And so what he did is that he just lied. And he said, you know, my relatives have given me this much money. And he got, like, the threshold was $250,000. He lied up to $251,000 is basically what he reported. And so I was just kind of fascinated with not a lot. I mean, there was so much in this indictment, but one of the big things he did was essentially stealing from the Republican Party by faking that he reached these thresholds and therefore getting support from the party. But just those thresholds are so high. And he kept complaining that, you know, I've got my back against a wall and I'm really stressed about this stuff. And I can imagine being stressed. I mean, having to raise $250,000 and do it again the next quarter.
I'm going to pause you right there, because you're feeding into what I want to get into at the end of this segment, which is the George Santos redemption arc. And I feel like you are already paving the way there. But first, Heaton, what stuck out to you with this?
All right. I read the synopsis of the report, and I read about, I don't know, a quarter of the individual details. It seems to me what I read had left out OnlyFans. Was that dropped? Because that was the thing that really stood out to me.
It's in there.
We don't know the dollar amount. It was really just like a one-off thing. And that was like, petty. There wasn't much detail.
It was petty in the writing of the report. You can tell they go through a lot of pains to explain how much Santos avoided this investigation and how much he obfuscated it. So I think just listing OnlyFans as one of the expenditures without a dollar amount was just them being petty and saying, all right, well, you want to play games? Here's, you're an OnlyFans subscriber.
It's really funny, by the way. Like, it's really funny. When I was reading news reports, the OnlyFans bit is the bit that made me laugh out loud. I wish I worked as hard at anything as George Santos does at lying. I think that guy works so goddamn hard at it's like he loves lying and he's putting his all into it. Like I watched part of an interview he did the other day where they were like, so you claim to be Jewish? And he's like, no. I said I was Jew-ish. It was a joke. Everybody laughed. Everybody knew what I was talking about. And I'm working hard to prove that my grandparents did flee the Holocaust. And they're like, and you have documentation for this? And he's like, as soon as I get it, I'm going to get that to you. We're working on this day and night. And it is a farce of a serial liar. It's amazing. The thing that stands out to me about all of this is the psychological question mark that animates this man that I'm trying to understand, because there is a certain level of embellishment that I think everybody does, in the sense of I am going to give you the correct facts about myself, but I'm going to present them in the most favorable light I can. I think everybody does that to some extent. There's like another notch up for politicians of like graduated from Harvard when in reality did like a study abroad at Harvard or something like that. Right. So, okay. It's sort
I
of
went
based
to a
in
cooking
fact.
Class at Harvard. So exactly. I'm a culinary chef from Harvard. And the yes. way that I define that is my cooking class was in Harvard Square.
Yeah, exactly. So if you were running for Congress, Jen, you would just say Harvard educated, except you probably wouldn't, because you'd do it when you were talking to donors. Right. But like yeah. that kind of way. Once you got elected, then you'd put it on your Wikipedia page. Right. So there's that kind of thing where you're like, all right, you've taken it a bit too far, but you've got a foot in the door. There's a foot in the door of truth. And then there's George Santos, who is just untethered from reality in a way that I find hilarious only because he's been caught. It would be terrifying if he hadn't been caught. And what I wonder about is I'm genuinely curious as to is George Santos's brain broken in a way that when he lies, does he think he's telling the truth? Does his whole neural network reorient on a moment by moment basis to where he truly believes he's honest? Or alternately, does he think everyone in the world is also lying and there's nothing wrong? Or does he just not give a shit? Like it really is this kind of impenetrable black box of sociopathy that is what I am blown away by with this.
At the risk of trying to dive deep into the inner sanctum that is what makes George Santos tick, I don't think it's that complicated. I think he sees a thing in front of him. He wants the thing. He gets the thing. That's that. Everything else that we are going to put on it in terms of how much we should be trusting our public servants and blah, 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 throw it all out. This is just a man who wants a thing and gets it. The easiest way to get it is by lying. One of the most fascinating parts about this report is that in his first campaign, because remember, he ran twice. The first campaign, the people that he hires, they do what is standard, which is a vulnerability report. So your team is going to look into you the way that they would look in to other candidates.
Yeah, opposition research.
Yeah. And so they present him with the vulnerability report, which has all of this. Everything we found out, all of it, the fact that he didn't actually go to the schools he went to, that he didn't actually work at the places he went to, that he was broke. They've got it all. And they show it to him and they say, you need to quit. And he says, I don't think so. And they said, well, then we're going to quit. And he said, cool. And then the next people that came in saw the vulnerability report. And he's like, yeah, they got a lot of stuff wrong. Move on.
There you go.
That's yep. it. That was it. He just moseyed. And I want to clarify something that Jen said. He lied about money that was coming in so other donors wouldn't feel like an idiot that they were giving money to somebody who was late on his rent, which we have found out. But also because the Republican National Congressional Committee, and this is something, Heaton, you know how important this is when you are in Congress. When you're running, you want money from the party. You want money to come in so it can augment your campaign. But the Republican National Congressional Committee, because they need some kind of rules as to how they're going to give money, they need to show that you're already raising money, that they are not pouring the limited amount of resources that they have into a campaign that's not going anywhere. So how do you show that you have momentum? You lie! And he lied! And then he just got the money. And that's the reason why I think he is toast now, because we are close enough to the election that the thin margin that the Republicans have in the House doesn't matter. It's all chaos anyway. But everybody in the House, every Republican in the House had a dollar that they could have gotten toward their reelect gone to George Santos in the last cycle because he straight up lied.
Yeah. I mean, he's on the verge of being kicked out of Congress. I mean, I feel like he deserves to be kicked out of Congress for all of this because he's a straight up thief. But I can't get over the fact that we're getting ready to kick out George Santos while Bob Menendez remains in the Senate, because what Bob Menendez did was so much worse and harmful to the country. So it's like the real consequences are coming from stealing from the party and from the donors, but for like actually putting Americans like in danger, Bob Menendez.
Actual graft by a foreign power. Heaton?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is one of the other things that bothers me about this. Again, Santos himself is a clown. I've had friends that have encountered, I don't know the differences between sociopath, psychopath, and narcissist. I don't fully understand these differences, but I've had friends that have interacted with full-blown sociopaths, and in all of their experiences, they're very Santos-like, where they are capable of lying at an incredible degree right to your face, and it's just a minute-by-minute play for time. Every time. It's just a seat of the pants type situation. The bit that unnerves me is that short-sightedness built into sociopaths, or is it just that we catch the stupid ones? Are there people that are Santos only intelligent and smart and forward planning that just stick around forever? I don't know. Menendez doesn't strike me as like a serial liar the way Santos is. I think he's a different quality. Like I agree with your analysis there, Jen, that like Menendez should also be in prison and it's a horrible thing that the things with real consequences are not. I don't disagree with any of that. I'm worried that there are smarter versions of Santos that have not been brought to light and that they are in the system and will continue doing Santos level heists without the clownish stepping on rakes element of that buffoon.
I mean, I think we saw it in Donald Trump. Honestly, he's just now getting in trouble for the stuff that he's done, and he doesn't seem to have any remorse for his lying. So I think your suspicions are, I mean, what I know, I have a friend that we think might be a sociopath. And the thing is, like, they tend to be very charming, and he made a lot of money despite like lying to people. And and as long as the people don't get hurt or the job is actually based on the lying, like I'm sure there's plenty of real estate agents that do very well as sociopaths. Like there's certain jobs that where it's like, I think you can lie for a living and it's, you don't get in trouble because you're not really crossing a line. George Santos did this on a very big stage. And so, you know, I just think that there's probably plenty of people that lie like him, but the consequences aren't that big and the spotlight isn't as bright.
Well, this is the problem. Santos lied like Tommy Flanagan on Saturday Night Live. Like there was very little forethought to it. It was just like, hey, you actually need to have $250,000 to get RNCC funding. And he's like, oh, really? Well, I do have it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, you have to be Jewish to speak at this conference. That's funny. I am Jewish. I did go to this college. I do work here. I'm very rich. It's like, wait, didn't you owe money all over town? No, I don't. Like, weren't you that drag queen in Brazil? Nope, not me. There is just a absolutely clawed level lack of guile to all this that makes it truly, truly crazy. Now, Santos has said he's not running again, so he has at least removed himself from that. But I do want to go back to something that Jen said at the beginning. I got to the end of this, and I got to tell you, I like George Santos more than I did when I started reading this report. The Why? Balls on this guy, like just out of just obviously he's a fascinating media figure. People want to talk about him. They want to ask him questions just to see how he's going to lie his way out of it. I think that, presuming whether or not he's going to go to prison, there's no doubt that he has a future as a media person. And I think the thing that you said at the beginning of this, that, yeah, you want to know what? I did all of it, everything that's in there. I absolutely did it. And here's why I did it. Because money in politics is unfair. He would be a hero to the people who believe that money is ruining politics, and he can have a whole nother arc, a whole nother 5-year arc where he can realize that in the media, lying is the product. He doesn't have to go to a place where lying is a detraction. Come to the media side, George. This is your calling. You don't need to break any rules. In fact, you would be an immediate boon to any media outlet that you went to.
That's the most cynical take I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, this profession that we work hard to not lie in, like, come over here.
Well, in terms of the world of political analysis, where all you're doing is just, you know, one team go bad, you know, the other team's bad. Like, that's really what it's just all moral justification. So you can confirmation bias everybody. He can do that.
Can I play Fist of Justice for a minute here? He's very likely going to be expelled from Congress.
Yes.
Wouldn't surprise me if a DA in New York begins investigating him for what appears to be ribald neon fraud on stilts.
They are currently doing that. That is currently ongoing.
But I'm thinking on top of that, you can be held in contempt of Congress in the same way that you can be held in contempt of a court, right? Like if you're in a courtroom and you say, you know, screw you, judge, you will be held in contempt of court and you'll be given a jail sentence or something like that, right? This happens fairly regularly. In Congress, I don't think contempt of Congress is done hardly ever. And I believe what happens, because it's so rare, is that it goes to either the district attorney in Washington, D.C., or it goes to somebody in the Justice Department or something like that. I would say this is a rare but very good instance where he should be held in contempt of Congress and do jail time for it. He was doing willfully lying and fraud within the House in the House's business. And so if ever there were an instance where Congress should actually jail somebody, this is the guy. And so I think his podcast from prison would be very funny, Justin.
Yep.
I think this is the exact kind of person that needs to be in prison. This is a danger to people that are trusting and good and decent in our society that assume some kind of tether to the truth and basic human shame impulses will protect you on average. This is one of the people, this is part of the tiny minority of people that doesn't have that human thing in his brain. And he needs to be, we need protection from people like this. So I think
he's not that big a deal. I mean, I get that he's a thief, but like, he was doing this so he could get Botox and designer stuff. If anything, I feel bad for him.
Ferragamos.
Yeah. And Hermes, like he's definitely vain. I feel bad for him in certain ways. He was broke and he did a lot of lying. He wanted to be important, clearly, and he found a way to make it happen. But as far as like a danger to us all, him stealing from rich people and from the Republican Party and spending it on Hermes is not nearly as dangerous as Bob Menendez writing bills so that Ethiopia can't get money because there might be a war with Egypt. Like, that is really big, dangerous shit.
This is not an either-or situation.
Yeah. No, but it kind of is.
No, it's not.
I don't think George Santos I don't think George Santos is dangerous to anybody. I think he's a thief. But like, kicking him out of Congress, I think the country is safe with him wandering around the streets. I don't think he needs to serve hard time. Like, I do think that he's a thief, and I think he will, you know, have to serve some kind of time for what he stole, but I don't think he's a danger to society. I really don't.
Would you have him do any prison time?
I think he's materialistic. I don't think he's going to like physically hurt anyone.
I don't think he's going to physically hurt anybody. I think that there's a decent argument to make that in general, nonviolent offenders should be put on where they stay at home and then work it off. So like Jack Abramoff, Jack Abramoff, who we've both met at various times. He did part of his prison sentence, and then he had to basically work in order to pay off the people that he owed money to. He worked at a pizza place for a while. I think there's a very good argument to be made that that's the kind of thing that the justice system should do, because we're wasting lots of resources on putting people in cages, et cetera. So if we're having a big overarching systemic conversation about that, very open to it and inclined towards it. But like, I don't know, his motivations for stealing and who he stole from are both immaterial. He is a thief. He is a liar. I am worried about innocent people being duped by him. Menendez, bigger problem. For all the reasons you point out, Jen, I do not think this needs to be an either or proposition. I think you can go after a big fish and a little fish.
Yeah, I guess I'm just really struck because I put both those stories in one episode, and I just like there's so much attention being paid to Santos, and like, he's going to be facing so many consequences and the whole country's talking about him. And yet he's not the danger to our country. He's really not. He's a backbencher in a sea of 435 people. So I'm watching the difference in consequences, and it's really hard for me to get over and just watch that, because Santos is going to pay a price, and it's going to be very soon. And meanwhile, we have an actual threat over in the Senate. So I'm struggling to separate the two.
Yeah. I think that's the lens that you have put on it. I don't know if that is.
We have two people indicted, and one is going to be kicked out of Congress. And I don't think it's the right one. If we're only going to kick out one.
He's not running for reelection. Like,
who gives a shit? He's still in power for over a year.
I don't even want to walk down this road any further, because I don't think that we disagree. Like, I just don't know why this has to be an either or, that we have to let Santos go so we can punish Bob Menendez.
Hold on. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying Santos deserves to be kicked out of Congress, but he's the only one getting kicked out of Congress. We have another person under criminal indictment with far more serious charges. And the topic of conversation in the entire country is just this one guy. And we seem to have forgotten about the other one.
Because the ethics investigation just came out this week. Like, it's newsworthy.
And isn't it a problem that we're kicking out the guy who had an ethics investigation? And over in the Senate, there is no ethics investigation. Like, don't you see the two of these as kind of parallel?
My disagreement is that we don't disagree. Like, I am for all of this. I just don't know why it has to be counterweighted by the other one. I think the reason why this is a news story this week is because it has proximity to the report coming out. I do believe that there should be, I believe that there should have been an investigation into Menendez the last time he was under federal indictment, and he should have faced a more repercussion. So I am totally on your side there.
Yeah. And it's just kind of fascinating to me that like the House Republicans, who have been rightfully branded as unable to govern and, you know, kind of crazy. And the Democrats are saying, well, we are the good party. We are the governing party. And yet they're not holding their far more serious allegations in their own party in the branch of Congress that they control. They're not holding that guy accountable at all. And here we're watching the House Republicans with their very slim majority about to kick out one of their own. I think it's a bad look on the Democrats, and I just don't want Menendez to be forgotten, because right now it feels like he has been, and it's bothering me, man. It's bothering me big time.
This is a fair point, and I'm glad you're bringing it up, Jen. I think Santos is media catnip, and like theoretically, let's say that there are two stories before we're going through our rundown of things. When I worked in news every day, butt in seat at 8 a.m. show up with a list of stories we can talk about. Story one, a doctor has been embezzling, and it's resulted in death. Story two dildo trucks hit each other on the highway, and there are dildos flying across the highway, wiggling. I know which one of these is going to be a better story to talk about in the news. I don't disagree about the weight and importance of the former story. And so that's happening. And so for that reason, I appreciate you bringing us back to Bob Menendez. I think you're right about that. In terms of the weight of importance, Bob Menendez is a bigger one than Santos. Santos is the two dildo trucks colliding on I-35. Yes. That is what he is. It's super funny. It's super colorful. It's very easy to grasp immediately. When I tell you two dildo trucks have collided on the highway, it's great, right? Menendez, not as good media catnip. And I suppose the onus is on us, and hats off to Jen for focusing in on Menendez, who's the bigger threat.
More
hats to Jen.
Let me just say, as somebody who studies campaigns, that dude definitely won a contested seat in a blue state as a Republican with negative money. He squandered the stuff that he had coming in for ads. So it's like you go back and you look at that race and you're like, he is an exceptional candidate. Like, he certainly was able to win over. He won a very, very tough race with like no money. All the money that he had coming in, he spent on Hermes and Botox.
In New York, he ran as someone whose mom escaped from the Twin Towers.
She died from it later, from complications. Yeah.
From the fumes or whatever. Yeah. There's this one great paragraph.
After his grandparents, who were Jewish, fled the Holocaust. I mean, gosh.
I'm gonna also say this. This is something I said initially when the George Santos thing started. I'm not convinced he was born in America.
I'm not either.
after all this, it's like, no, there's his parents apparently immigrated. And then he also like, I don't know. I'm also a George Santos birther, but there we go.
Yeah, there's this beautiful paragraph in the ethics committee report where they just list all of the things in his background that he ran on. And then the final sentence of it was, none of this was found to be true.
None of this is true.
I like wanted to frame it. I'm like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in a government report.
I've mentioned this a couple of times on the program. There's a book whose title escapes me, but it's by Tim Urban. If anybody's familiar with the website, I forgot it now. But Tim Urban, popular web comic writer, wrote a book, and he posits that most of the arguments we have are mistakenly along the left right spectrum, and the real arguments that we're having are along a what I heat and I'm going to call the dickhead spectrum, and the dickhead spectrum is do I hold myself accountable to the same rules that I apply to my enemies. Is a situation where when the other team does a bad thing, I excoriate them. And when my team does it, I go, hey, fair's fair. My team's bad. Or do I let us off the hook and go, well, we're only doing it because the other team is evil. Right.
Yeah.
And you see this a lot. This is where we hopefully, if there's a God, we're at the high watermark of this in American politics in our lifetime, where the parties don't treat each other as if the rules apply. The parties act as though, you guys are the evil team. We're the good team. Therefore, we have to make exceptions because how could we possibly compete with the evil team? And the rules exist to restrain you, not us, because we're good. And Menendez is a decent example of that. I am with the Democrats on calling out Trump for trying to steal the 2020 election. I am in agreement with them. I have been the entire time. And it's a rather a glaring omission that Menendez is kind of quiet because there's a Republican governor in New Jersey, and it's convenient to us.
There's a Democrat.
Oh, is there? So yeah. Wait, why aren't they kicking him out then?
Excellent question.
I just forgive me, listeners and colleagues. I just assumed that this was naked party politics where they went, well, we can't kick him out because a Republican get it. Yeah. What's does he just have a lot of cachet or he's a lot of dirt on the other people?
They're hoping that he has shame and just doesn't run again. And so the problem goes away. He has shown no sign that that is going to happen. And so everybody is just kind of holding it until they eventually shit their pants. Metaphorically. Yeah.
The first time he was arrested for corruption, Chris Christie was the governor. And so they let him stay. And now they're giving him, I don't know. I don't understand the rationale. I think it's because they're friends with him and because he's been there for a long time. He was a leader of the party. I think it's more that. But right now, where there's a Democratic governor, like there really is no political consequences for kicking him out, which is why it's that much worse to me that he remains a senator and will remain a senator for, and like you actually had a good point that I forgot about. The Democrats for years were telling us that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, was a agent of a foreign government, basically accusing him of being a Russian agent and saying it was the worst thing in the world. And now we have an actual criminal indictment, which I find incredibly credible. In fact, I did some research for my own show and found some stuff that wasn't even in the indictment, like a bill that he read or that he wrote that I think was obviously going to be a favor to Egypt in one way or another. So it's like, I have very serious doubts about his motivations. My trust level of this man is at a zero. And he's accused of doing, by the Justice Department, the exact thing that the Democrats were squawking about, saying that Trump was doing, being an agent for a foreign country. So it's like, the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party in this is so beyond and so shameful. Yeah, I'm struggling to get over
that there is gambling in this hole.
I know.
The party of peace, the Democratic Party, the party of peace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we are going to get rid of one of the two indicted probably because the chairman of the ethics committee has already filed the resolution needed to pull up the next vote to expel him. And I've been seeing people that voted no the first time.
Oh, yeah.
Saying he's on Twitter toast. That they're voted. Yeah, I'll be surprised if he lasts into December, honestly. So
yeah,
one of the two will be gone. Good riddance. But we still have one more problem.
I'll help with your podcast, George. Give me an email.
Or a feel good, bipartisan, Latino presidential ticket.
There we go. There we go. I'll tell you what, New York, New Jersey, they can finally agree on something. Or is it Menendez Santos? Ask one of them. They'll tell you the opposite because they don't give a shit. These guys don't give a shit. Whatever. Pay for play. Or with Santos, don't. He'll lie. He'll make up his own bribes. He invented money. That was the other thing. I thought he was going to go down because he was tied to this pyramid scheme in Florida. And so I thought when he had all this money, he was clearly broke. I'm like, okay, he's washing money that he got from this pyramid scheme. No, he was just a broke bitch who just lied and said that he had money. What the balls, the low hangers, the scrapers on Santos.
Are you going to miss him? I feel like you're going to miss him.
No, I think if he becomes a media person, it would be very interesting. I think it would be a sugar high, but I am blown away by somebody who is that big of a liar, but also is bad at it. Like terribly. Yeah. He's not even like it's not even like he's hiding. He just straight out and also get caught. The reason why he got caught on camera with all this in 4K was that he was texting his treasurer to do this. Like they got all these text messages. This was not a smart man. This was a man who just out and out lied and is continuing to lie because just follow the momentum.
Little advice, listeners, from Lord Uncle Heaton. If you've got something financial that might need to come up in the future, get it in writing. Let's say you're moving into an apartment and you're like, who owns the couch when we leave the apartment? Be sure to email your roommate, not in a creepy way, just so you both have a record of it. Conversely, if you're doing something illegal, do it in person. Don't write it down. This is page two shit. Don't do it in anything that could be copied and pasted. Never do anything illegal in anything that could be copied and pasted.
Well, and despite all of those texts existing, his defense for all this was like, oh, it was the treasurer's fault. Like, I didn't know it. She like, it was up. All her. Yeah. He just threw her right under the bus. So he's also a very stand up guy, obviously.
See, I wonder, like, this is where I think you could have fun with this. Like, I think I've mentioned on this program before, and I won't go through the whole thing. I got invited to do an East Wing tour, or no, a West Wing tour at the White House one time during the Trump administration. And I ended up turning it down because I already had Risk scheduled and wanted to go play Risk. And I was like, in the non-zero chance I meet the president, what would I say to him? And what I came up with was, an honor to meet the president and the White House. Your socks are fine. They're fine. And then if he followed up and be like, people say you have boring socks, but I think the president should. And then the goal would be to see if you could get Trump to wear like bright red socks. And with Santos, I feel like you could lead him in really fascinating directions. Cause whenever I see him in media interviews, he wants to be liked. He wants to be like, right? Yes, yes. I agree with you. Like, no, that's a really big problem. But I wonder if you couldn't be like, you know, a lot of people in your district think they're vampires and are going for a vampire candidate. And he's like, I actually was bitten by a bat. I think you could get him to admit to like really fun stuff. Like you could have fun with it.
Did we ever find out why he was running around screaming while holding a baby?
No.
Did we ever get the backstory on that?
Yeah. I mean, and that's.
I couldn't shoehorn it into my episode. There was no reason for it to be there, but I was just like, that is still the weirdest thing he's done.
So yeah, carrying a baby and then screaming at a reporter for asking about the baby of how dare you disturb me while I'm holding this baby. I am in awe of the chutzpah. Something that Santos would be familiar with since he's Jewish.
Yes.
But I am, or at least we are the same amount of Jewish, me and George Santos. The absolute gall, the unmitigated gall of this guy after reading this report, that it wasn't even like Menendez is old school from the beginning of democracy graft, that kind of stuff. He is doing things that, you know, this is Teapot Dome. This is every scandal that's ever happened in terms of money for favors. That's Menendez. And he is doing it and he is hiding it in the way that you traditionally do it. And he's going to defend himself using these tried and true stratagem. Santos had no plan except to say, actually, I do have the answer, regardless of the fact that he didn't. And that's just it. That was his only play. And even now in that report, they're like, we've just busted you on doing all this. He's like, no, you haven't. It's like, well, we have actually, we have you in writing and this other person has just flipped on you and everybody is telling us. He's like, meh, don't think you have. Don't think you have. Anyway, I'm going to let your corrupt court go about your business. I'm not going to run. I'm going to sashay down to my district and continue to run. That being said, amazing that he won that seat with zero money.
It really is. And I will give him this. His Botox looks good. And I do think he can dress. So at least the donor's money wasn't wasted.
And at least plug the OnlyFans model. That OnlyFans model deserves the credit. At least let that person make some cash.
Yeah.
I would like to know what the account is. Like, is he looking at people's feet? Like, what's his thing? I don't know.
Oh, it's gotta be some hard
I wanted
body.
More details. Like, as soon as we got to the OnlyFans word, I was like, here we go. And like they just breezed nothing. Right by it.
Wait, I hate to open this can of worms again, but are we sure he's gay? Because he was married to a gal for a little bit and now he's gay. And so could be, because this frequently happens, repressive local culture, tries to be straight, all that. I've met people that have done that realize later in life, no, I'm gay. I'm going to own this. Right. But also he's a serial liar. So like, is he actually married to a dude? Is he actually gay? Do we have any idea? Did this come up with the report?
No, but I don't think that's a crime.
I don't. Yeah. It did not interrogate his sexuality per se. My assumption is that he is indeed gay. Although in some Latin cultures, you're only gay if you're catching. It's not gay if you're pitching.
Ew.
Yeah.
That's how the Romans were. The yeah. Romans, their homosexuality, in my opinion, came out of deep set misogyny. The Romans were so misogynist that if you were pitching, that was fine. It's as long as you weren't playing the woman. It was bad to be in the role of a woman. That was how the Romans thought about it.
Okay.
Well, there we go. Patreon.com/we're not wrong if you want to support this kind of content. And boy, it's crazy. You want to know, we just got a patron for $400,000. We're just going to go with the George Santos model of accounting.
We now
have thousands of patrons. We are the number one podcast on Patreon. Just kidding. We are honest. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Thank you to everybody who supports us. Join us. And even on this holiday week, we are working hard the day before Thanksgiving, and we will give you a bonus episode about Thanksgiving travel being at an all-time high here in America post-pandemic. So go ahead and get that. And if you are not a patron, understand, these Patreon episodes, they go places. They go places. The initial topic is very rarely where we end up. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Okay, we're going to do this a little bit differently. Normally, I just read a little intro and then you guys, having studied the topic, have your own takes on it. But I'm going to walk you guys through this chapter by chapter. And I'm just going to let you guys ask questions because, to my knowledge, either of you are per se up on the OpenAI situation beyond the AI stuff that I constantly bring to the fore. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've studied nothing about this. I've heard that a CEO left and went to Microsoft. Beyond that, I know nothing.
That's okay. I know like 5%. I know that there's been a bit of a yo-yo where he left and then the board of directors or the investors were like, no, come back. And like something like that. That's about all I know.
All right.
Go ahead.
Sam Altman, last week, November 16th, fired as CEO of OpenAI. OpenAI is the fastest growing startup in Silicon Valley history.
They're ChatGPT, yeah?
They are ChatGPT, yes. Okay. DALL-E and ChatGPT. Those are the two forward-facing products of OpenAI. GPT-4 is their big product that they have since been selling enterprise licenses to various different businesses. But as far as that product, GPTs, and what you interact with in these other two services, they are by far the leader. They have lapped Meta. They have lapped Google. And as we are going to get to, they are aligned with certain elements of Silicon Valley. This was the press release that came along with that firing. Quote, Mr. Altman's departure
follows a deliberate review process by the board, which concluded that he was not consistently candid in his communications with the board, hindering his ability to exercise its responsibilities. The board no longer has confidence in his ability to continue leading OpenAI. Now,
okay,
if you were to read that, what would you think?
Well, no, like it sounds like if I were to hear that, I'd be like, oh, okay, he's a pathological liar and the board doesn't trust him. Like, I would assume that he did something. Did he do anything?
Would you believe with that kind of language that that there was something else? There was more to this story that he has been dismissed.
Yes. I mean, that they basically said in a polite way that he was non-communicative with the board and there were communication difficulties. That doesn't seem to be enough to remove somebody. So I would think there's probably more than that. But I would infer probably like personal conflicts or something based on just that scant amount of details.
Okay. Now, technically, this is important. OpenAI is a nonprofit company that has a for-profit arm. Sam Altman runs the for-profit arm of OpenAI. Pause. Yes.
That doesn't make any sense. You're either for-profit or you're not. How can you be both?
So OpenAI was founded many years ago by Sam Altman and Elon Musk, amongst a few others, as a nonprofit that was there to say, we believe AI, and specifically what we're going to get to in a little bit, AGI, the idea of creating a computer that can think in a way beyond what we have now, which just basically is spitting out what it is assuming is going to be the next word, that is going to be the biggest invention in the history of the world. And it is too important for it to be totally confined within a corporate structure in Silicon Valley. And so therefore, this nonprofit needs to help lead research and hopefully democratize AI beyond what would normally happen if it were just a product in Silicon Valley. What okay. they found was that this is really expensive to move forward. You can't just study it. What you need is a lot of computing power. And so they created a for-profit arm, because that when they would go to these venture capitalists and they would say, hey, you believe that AI is a real problem? And they go, yeah. It's like, well, we have a nonprofit. Can you give us millions and millions of dollars, if not, you know, hundreds of millions and up to $1 billion? They go, no, for a nonprofit, too much. And then they said, well, what if we were a startup? Oh, can we give you $1 billion right now? So they decided they were going to be a for-profit arm of OpenAI. And that has been what has moved everything forward. That has created GPT-3, GPT-4, DALL-E, ChatGPT, all of that. That came from the for-profit arm because OpenAI got $1 billion investment, at least in terms of the initial announcement, from Microsoft. That's who has essentially been the backbone of them running all these processes and training the model and ChatGPT specifically, in terms of it being a big success. Now, the key thing about this structure is you have to realize. Hi, Tim. I'm recording a podcast.
Thanksgiving week.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, good. I know. Tim. I know. Hey, Tim. Yes.
Hi, Tim. Nice to have you here.
Yes. Thank you.
Shall we continue? Do you want to tell us who Tim is? What do you want?
Tim's my mom's boyfriend. So for many, many years. So he has decided that now is the time to clear the trash. Okay. What you had to
I wish he'd been a little bit more dismissive. I wish he'd been like, when you're done playing with your friends, do you want to come get some V8?
Okay, so what you have to remember about the OpenAI structure is that their board is not like other for-profit company boards that are beholden to either the shareholders or the investors to maximize profit. They are a nonprofit board who are beholden to their ideals of making AI safe. So that means that they have more leeway to do what they did, like totally jeopardize an $86 billion company by firing the CEO with no warning to anybody and with a very, very vague
press release essentially calling him a liar, which made people think, at least initially I did. I'm like, well, the FBI has got to be knocking on his door if they are, this is all happening so fast. Heaton.
I just want to make sure I understand the organization here, as I think this will probably play into the corporate skullduggery we're about to dive into. So OpenAI is a nonprofit. There is a for-profit wing. The for-profit enterprise that's a subgroup of this, its board of directors is the board of directors for OpenAI. So there's not like an annual shareholders meeting or anything like that. There's just a group of people from OpenAI, the nonprofit, that are ultimately the directors of the profit wing of it.
Yes, that is okay. That is exactly what it is. Now, what you also have to understand is that there is a big philosophical divide in the world of AI. On one side, you have people who are for effective altruism. And if that sounds familiar, because Sam Bankman-Fried was a big believer in effective altruism, then that is where you've heard it before. But effective altruism is a philosophy that focuses on using evidence and reasoning to determine the most effective way to benefit others. In the context of AI, EA advocates for responsible and ethical development of AI technologies, emphasizing the importance of ensuring these advancements are used to improve global well-being, mitigate risk, and address societal changes effectively and equitably. For many of them, that means over the last year, AI development has been going too fast. So what you might have seen in part of the discussion around this is the idea of deceleration, that AI development is going too fast. And so we need to do it slower, because otherwise AI is going to become too powerful, too beneficial, will be monetized too much, and will not benefit humanity.
So what I'm hearing is that people that actually know what they're talking about are also concerned about this moving too fast. So I'm not completely insane.
Well, that is not the entirety of the world of AI. Some people believe that there should be effective acceleration, that this is not a real risk right now, that the issue with AI is going to be in the future. We are greatly benefiting society by continuing to move AI forward at this pace. And anybody who's thinking about pumping the brakes at this stage is going to be actively hurting not only the company itself, but also humanity in general, because right now the bottom billion for the cost of having a cell phone with a data plan has essentially a physician on call, because something that can pass the board to be a doctor can actually give them solid advice, at least more than they would have otherwise without the ability to afford anything. So that is the argument. There's a rift, and there appears to be on the board more folks who are effective altruists and decelerationists. And that is being speculated is part of the reason why Altman was dismissed.
This gotcha. Is fascinating. This is not, I did not think that it was going to be what is you're describing an ideological rift. I thought it was going to be personal animosity or some kind of incompetency or malfeasance in terms of corporate governorship.
So there's that too, because it is a Silicon Valley story, which means that there is conflict of interest. One of the people on the board is the founder of Quora, the question and answer platform. And they just announced this year a question and answer thing powered by AI called Poe. Last week, and apparently an inflection point for Sam Altman's firing, there was a developers conference wherein OpenAI introduced chat or GPTs, the ability for anybody to create their own specialized version of ChatGPT, so you can just do things faster. You don't have to enter in like you are a blah, 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 blah. People can do that for you and then share their versions of it online. That's actually available for everybody right now. But there was questions when Altman got fired. Wait a minute. Why is it only after OpenAI with ChatGPT, the far more successful product, announces something that is competing with one of the board members' own products, does the CEO get fired for what we, you know, have no actual firm evidence is anything other than an ideological rift?
Okay.
So if I'm following here, Sam Altman opens up a side project that is not a part of the umbrella of OpenAI, and it is in conflict with a board member's around.
This is OpenAI's product, GPTs. ChatGPT now has a new thing that you can do within it. So it was the for-profit arm of OpenAI that just created a product that directly competed with one of the nonprofit board members' own products. And then all of a sudden, Sam Altman's fired.
That's the nonprofit board member, their product is within OpenAI, or they have a separate. Okay.
They have their own company, Quora. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that. Quora. The poor man's Reddit, where you go on and you're like, my golf cart's broken. And like three people go like, well, have you tried kicking it? And like Quora. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then they close the thread and it's useless. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So this is what happens in the initial press release. Mira Murati is named the CEO of OpenAI. So Sam Altman out, Murati in. This kicks off.
Girl power.
Yeah. So there we go. 35-year-old woman named the CEO of the fastest rising tech startup of all time. Employees and investors react insane to this. They're like, wait a minute. What happened? Why did this happen? There is a very, very poor reaction to an all hands meeting that is called by the remaining folks on the board who work at OpenAI, trying to explain why they did it. The employees are not handling it well. They do not take their reasoning particularly well. And almost immediately, Sam Altman is thought to be brought back. There's negotiations that Sam Altman's going to come back as the CEO, 24 hours after he was fired. He posts on Twitter himself with a guest badge for OpenAI saying, this will be the last time I ever have one of these, only for him to not be brought back and the CEO of Twitch to be brought in as the new CEO. So Mira Murati out. Now Emmett Shear, one of the co-founders of Twitch, who had just left the company about 9 months ago, he now comes in as the CEO of OpenAI because Murati had supported Sam Altman coming back.
Okay.
All right. Wait, excuse me. Murati was going to be his replacement?
She was named as his replacement. She supported on Twitter Sam Altman coming back. And so she was kicked out within.
She would have willfully stepped down in order to make room for him to come back.
Was she always supposed to be a temp? Because if she's supporting someone else getting the job, or is this considered like, do people that know things be like, wow, she got screwed?
I don't think anyone has any kind of idea what the fuck was happening at that point. This was a total clusterfuck. Nobody really understood. I mean, for the first 12 hours after this happened, most people were assuming that there was another shoe to drop, that we were going to find out that Sam Altman was going to be arrested, or that there was some like Heaton mentioned, some gigantic corporate malfeasance that would have led to a sudden and fairly callous action by the board. As it became clear,
he stole money from
the
company and got Botox and an OnlyFans
and Hermes and Ferragamos and OnlyFans subscriptions. Yeah, we were just kind of assuming that all of that was going to come out. It didn't. And the further it got away from that, the more this simply just looked like, for ideological reasons, the board decided to put in peril an $86 billion company. And
now, did the board say anything? Because obviously people have questions. Has anyone reached out to these people and been like, what were you thinking? Have they said anything, or are they quiet?
The only thing that was said to the employees, as has been reported on Friday, was read the press release. There's more in there than you might think.
There you go.
Was there?
So no,
employees are grumbling. Think harder, employees. We were watching you read the press release. We don't think you did your homework.
So then they tease that Sam's basically, you're holding it wrong was essentially their fire back for any kind of complaints. So then they tease that Sam's going to come back. Sam doesn't come back. The Twitch CEO comes in. And it's at that point that things start to get really fucking weird. 770 of OpenAI's 790 employees sign a petition saying they are going to quit unless the board resigns. And
oh my God, that's amazing.
Microsoft says in one tweet, an amazing tweet by CEO Satya Nadella, "We welcome Emmett Shear, the new CEO of OpenAI. We very much believe for our Microsoft stockholders that everything that we have put on our roadmap that involves OpenAI, we're going to be able to do." Same tweet, not a different tweet, same tweet. Also, we're hiring Sam Altman, and anybody who wants to come over from OpenAI can have their exact same jobs at Microsoft. Therefore, essentially offering to gut OpenAI as a company and put all of the momentum of this for-profit company under the umbrella of Microsoft.
But if they're investors in the for-profit arm of OpenAI.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess stealing the whole company, I guess, would be more profitable. I guess those motivations seem like opposite to me. Like, destroy the thing you're invested in, but then if you steal the whole thing, I guess, like, in the end, you'll make more money.
My read on it, I don't know what, actually, do you know what percentage they have of, because it's like private stock, right? Like, there is stock 49. In it, but it's privately held.
I don't know everything. And also, disclosure announcements, I did contract work for OpenAI. I know people that worked at OpenAI, and my wife used to work for Twitch. So as you might imagine, as we were watching this from across the world in Zagreb, there was a lot of internal interest between my wife and I in all of these goings on. But there's rumors of exactly how much Microsoft has invested. It's certainly over $1 billion. There have been rumors and reports that it could be up to $10 billion and that there are further plans for a large scale investment, and that Microsoft could own as much as 49% of the for-profit arm of OpenAI for their investment.
So it's kind of theirs anyway, in a way. Maybe.
But they could be overruled by those four board members from the nonprofit that is technically squatting above them.
So this is a way to take control of all of it.
Sounds right.
And get rid of that board that gives a damn about humanity.
Well, I mean,
because really correct me if I'm wrong, because what I'm hearing is that this Sam dude is probably on team, let's go fast and break things and let's make as much money as we can. And the board is, let's be careful. Am I wrong?
I think that is a very gross oversimplification of it.
That's like what I'm trying to do. Yes. Oversimplify it.
I think that's fair, but perhaps overly valenced. Our earlier conversation, Jen, where I brought up downwingers and upwingers, both believe that they are benefiting humanity, right? So I think your portrayal of them as being cautious and ideologically concerned about the development of it would be correct. But I take slight issue saying, like, he doesn't give a fuck about humanity.
I didn't say that. Also, I said, go fast and break things. I mean, that was literally one of these tech guys' slogans. So
yes. And let me say, in the world of tech analysis, which I have been a part of for, I guess, 10 or 15 years at this point, Sam Altman is not in the, like, Elon Musk, Travis Kalanick realm of fuck it. Let's just go break laws. As long as the people are into it, then everything else will work itself out. We don't want to go at the speed of government. Sam Altman has been in many ways the friendly face of AI that has gone to Capitol Hill from the very beginning, that has talked to any senator that has wanted to, that has welcomed the idea of regulation. Now, that is a whole nother conversation that we can have on whether or not critics of Sam Altman say that that is him pushing for regulatory capture, but at least in terms of what you are talking about, the go fast and break things side of it, he seems to, at least by all available accounts in comparison to his peers, be more of a slow walker than that, and has been very forward about how important AI is and how it needs to be developed responsibly. Now, was he going too fast for the effect of altruists? Was he going too fast for the decelerators?
The board?
Almost assuredly, yes.
Okay, so the board wanted to slow it down and he didn't.
The board did not trust him to go as slow as they wanted, I think would probably be my takeaway from it. But then again, we don't know what the board wanted because the board hasn't said shit. The board has said things that he wasn't fired for. They have said that there wasn't malfeasance. They have said that it wasn't because of a safety issue, but we have yet to really know exactly what the point of it was. And the big person that was on the side of the board kind of being righteous was that the chief scientist of OpenAI, I always screw up his name, Ilya Sutskever, he initially was on the side of Sam being gone. And he was the one that had to talk to the employees about it. On Sunday night, he flips and says he greatly regrets the supporting the board's actions, and he's going to do everything he possibly can to reunite the company.
Is that possible if this Altman guy's already been hired by Microsoft? Like, can you put the genie back in the bottle?
Funny you should mention, because this morning, as we record this on Wednesday, Sam Altman is rehired as the CEO of OpenAI, given his blessing from Microsoft. Sam Altman is now back in charge. He will be governed by a new initial board of Brett Taylor from Salesforce, Larry Summers, former Obama appointee, and Adam D'Angelo. Adam D'Angelo is the guy from Quora that theoretically has the competing product. He is, at least as of announced right now, the only holdover from that last board. So throughout all of this, Sam Altman, after being teased to come back once and then not coming back, now is back. He is the CEO, and all of the employees that threatened to quit now do not have to quit.
So this is a classic procedural sitcom episode where crazy shenanigans happen, but everything goes right back to how it was at the end of the episode. Like, nothing actually changes for viewers the fall. Like, you could have slept through this last week and it will be exactly the same on the other side as it was previous.
That's not how I'm hearing it. I'm hearing it as the board that wanted to be cautious is now gone.
Well, we don't know.
Excuse me. If Sam Altman is the protagonist, but yes, the board composition changed, but Sam Altman and the employees.
Yeah, he didn't think more season finale than a mid-season episode, and you might have it. So, yeah, the show is going to reasonably be the same, but all the characters are going to be around, but it will be materially different. And, Jen, it is because of that reason. We don't know what the makeup of this board is going to be, but it does appear that the nonprofit board is going to be more aligned with the for-profit side than it was before. That seems clear. And by all reporting, that was a prerequisite for Sam to come back, was that he did not want to be dealing with a board that was capable
firing him.
Well, I mean, firing him. Yeah. I mean, I guess certainly there is that. But with that level over what appears to be an ideological rift and was not discussed with him, at least by any reporting beforehand. He got 15 minutes to say that there was a Google Meet for him to join. He joined it, was told he was fired, and that was that.
With these board of directors, to back up to the kind of the foundational elements of OpenAI, are these directors, the three of the four that got canned, were they founders of OpenAI? Was these four people got together and formed all of this?
No.
So it's not, how did they get into that position as board members? Like, if it's not a publicly held company, what was the mechanism by which they ascended to power in the first place?
There were co-founders on it. Ilya was a co-founder. Greg Brockman was a co-founder. They were on the board. When they fired Sam, they also demoted Greg off the board. And they said that he was going to stay with the company. He wound up quitting. So there were two people that were actually involved with things. Other than that, they were like any other business board. They were from other elements of society that were going to provide governance for this organization, including academics and other Silicon Valley people.
Okay. All right.
Well, I mean, I guess, so you obviously know these characters better and you seem to have a trust in Sam Altman, but I'm kind of hearing, like, big picture is that this company that is by far the most ahead when it comes to this new technology just kind of got a green light to be less cautious, is what I'm hearing. So I'm not hearing this as good news from my perspective as someone who's concerned about this technology.
I don't understand where they thought it was making it safer, because OpenAI is not the only people doing it. And effectively what they would have done was had gotten rid of any governor that they had over this company. They would have essentially put this company under the umbrella of Microsoft, which
I don't know how many people, you know, just remember the 90s, but they are among the most ruthless tech companies of all time. So I don't quite understand where they thought, where the board thought this was going to achieve their goals any more than they had.
They probably, I mean, presumably the board did not foresee Microsoft cannibalizing them, nor Sam Altman coming back and purging the board that had tackled him. Like normally, I mean, I know very little about corporate governance. I do not know about how board of directors works beyond very, very skin deep level stuff. But my assumption would be that normally the board of directors does not fear the CEO who works at their command. Their ability to fire him would generally be a buffer. And it looks like he came back with the army of Microsoft at his disposal and ousted three of them. I doubt they saw any of that coming. I don't think it was, they went, well, let's kick him out. And if he takes half of our force with him to Microsoft, fine. I don't think anybody was thinking that.
Well, yeah. And to have the vast majority of the employees basically within, I mean, this was all happening within the last week. So to have a mass mobilization of the employees, to have almost all of them say we're leaving, I don't think you can put that in the expected category.
Well, yeah.
I think that part is cool. I mean, good on them.
Was not on their side. They did not tell Microsoft it was going to happen before it happened. I guess they gave them like a 5-minute heads up before they released the press release. I think they believed more of the business community was going to be on their side. There's also reports that they tried to merge with another company with a bunch of ex OpenAI employees, Anthropic, during this entire process. So there's a lot that people are going to continue to unpack from it. But to the philosophical divide, Jen, I still think that OpenAI is a pretty responsible governor of it. I have not seen anything that makes me believe that they are endangering us. They're at least making noises that they do care about it. Now, obviously people inside thought that that was not the case and, you know, risked the fastest growing startup of all time over their belief. But that feels to me like a Berkeley dinner party gone wrong than it does anything actually serious.
I had no idea that the effective altruism movement was associated with AI skepticism. I've been trying to get Will McCaskill on the Political Orphanage for a year now, who's the godfather behind effective altruism. And I've read part of his book and I like what I read so far. It's a very empirical, data focused way of trying to maximize the impact of charitable giving. I like the whole idea behind it. I like the people in it. Is this just some of the people went, they took that and have arrived at a AI skeptic position? Or is the movement broadly downwinger cautious about AI?
From my understanding, effective altruism is something that went from, boy, we should use spreadsheets when we make our charitable donations to how can we, the smart people, affect the world better? And so when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail, we're the smart people, we are nervous about AI. And so now deceleration is a huge thing. And we are doing it under the banner of effective altruism. And so I don't necessarily think that the idea of being smart about where you give money is tied to AI doomerism or anything, but it does appear that the strain of that philosophy found a home in the idea of AI decel.
Okay. All right.
So Justin,
yes,
you are the one out of the three of us who loves this AI topic. You've just watched this whole drama.
Oh yeah.
What do you think?
It was the biggest clusterfuck of all time. Like, I was trying to think of it. There's nothing else that I could even, that you can even put in the same category. Like, there was a moment on Sunday night, or at least it was Sunday night in Zagreb, where it looked like Microsoft had, it's called in the business aqua hiring. So if, you know, a media company wanted to buy We're Not Wrong, instead of paying us for the property. They could just hire all three of us. And now we just have jobs and we just keep doing We're Not Wrong. And now it's just under their banner that they acqui-hired an $86 billion company. They did not pay $86 billion for it or whatever you would normally do for a company that valuable. They literally just had everybody walk across the street and they were the good guys for it. And it was because the board was so reckless. Again, philosophical stuff aside, even if you believe very much that there are reasons why Altman had to go, the way that you go about it is far different than just firing him on a Friday and assuming everybody's going to forget about it on Monday. This was irresponsible on so many levels. And if you take this stuff seriously, if you take deceleration seriously, then I think what they did more to harm that movement than anything that they could have done. And certainly more than just standing pat.
I'm curious about the massive majority of employees that voted to walk out. I think you said it was 720 out of 780.
770 was the last thing.
770 out of 790. So it's a huge amount. That is fascinating to me, but I don't know a lot about it. On first blush, I'd go, wow, he was overwhelmingly popular. But then I'm thinking about it and I'm like, well, he's okay with working on the for-profit side. I would imagine that the people that are working in the for-profit wing have probably been given private pre-IPO stock. And so they're looking at that going, hey, we want the profit guy so that we can cash out when this goes public. And if you replace him with something else, maybe like, is there, how much of this is him being popular and them caring about either ideology or the direction of the company versus how much of it is self-interested IPO cash out later on or some other self-interested element?
From my understanding of OpenAI, they are at a very, very interesting inflection point in that nobody believes that this is the biggest thing they're going to do. No one believes that ChatGPT is not going to be fundamentally different, bigger, and more important in a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now than what it is right now. So not only is Sam Altman popular, not only is Sam Altman popular because he might make people there rich, but also he's popular because they're winning. They're blowing out of the water these other companies. You know, the idea of the transformer that is the T in ChatGPT, that was invented by Google. OpenAI took it and has now lapped Google to the point where Google might not have a truly competitive product for years. You know, that they have not been able to do that thus far. So this is, you know, I think for a lot of the people that work there that are very proud of their work, they just felt like their team got decapitated for reasons that were not explained to them by a board that did not seem to be particularly interested in being held accountable. And their goal was to force this guy back. They tried once, failed, they tried twice, and they did it. So there we go. The OpenAI saga.
Final question.
Go.
I cannot currently buy any stock in ChatGPT, correct? This is still a privately held company with no immediate plans to go public?
No, the smart idea was to buy Microsoft stock when it cratered after the news that Altman was getting fired. That was the smart idea because then it shot up when it said that Altman was hired. And now this is probably the best scenario for Microsoft because they get almost all the benefits of OpenAI without being responsible for them. OpenAI can still fuck up and Microsoft can say
they're like sponsors of OpenAI as opposed to managers of OpenAI. Yeah.
But meanwhile, they get every benefit you could imagine. They get exclusive access to the OpenAI API, to the new technology. They're building stuff together. So it's like that's huge. All right. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Again, we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. As a large language model, we ask you to email we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Stop knocking the homeless people, you assholes, writes. It wasn't homeless people who lit the fire under the 10. It was arson by the person who owns the property under the bridge. They were being sued by the state of California for subleasing the property to other people. The owner lit it on fire as revenge against the government.
Did this person provide any source for that?
They wrote an angry email.
Okay. Well, next time provide a source and maybe we'll believe you.
Bad Faith Prognostication writes, now that Javier Milei has won the presidency of Argentina, I can already picture how the political debates will go depending on the success. For Jen, when Argentina ultimately gets better, your retort is going to be, quote, well, it was due to the previous administration's policy finally taking effect. And for Andrew, when Argentina ultimately gets worse, your response is going to be, well, that wasn't real libertarianism, and or it's all the CIA's fault. How do you respond to these pre-crimes?
It's so fun when people think that they know who I am and what I think and tell me what my reaction is going to be to things. Like, it's not obnoxious at all.
I think I did a very good job hemming, hawing, and getting myself a lot of lawyerly wiggle room on this topic in advance for the very good reason that I don't really know Argentinian politics very well. And while I'm like generally inclined and happy about Javier Milei, I also don't know a whole lot about him either beyond maybe an hour's worth of cursory work. I do think it'll get better because I think the main thing he ran on was that inflation is absolutely horrible and it's eating up any ability of the poor to get better and the middle class and everything else. I think that's going to get better. And I think the country's generally going to get better. If the country's economy gets worse, if the value of their, if the purchasing power gets worse and the ability of people to save money gets worse, I suppose I will need to look into that and perhaps even reinvestigate some of my priors.
I mean, I just hope that things get better. Like the idea that this emailer is like, oh, I just hate when people do that. But when it comes to Argentina, like if there are economic policies that I don't think are going to work, but end up working, fantastic. I would like for every country to have a population that can afford things and is comfortable, including my own country, including Argentina. So I hope it works out for him. I just think this guy is a little interesting, waving chainsaws around and wanting to cut every government agency. Like, good luck. I mean, I do have doubts about hiring people to run a government that don't believe in government. I don't go to Christian Scientists for my medical care. And there's a reason. It's because they don't believe in it. So yeah, I have doubts, but I hope it works out for him. We'll see.
There's been some really funny articles from the Babylon Bee about this. There was a picture of a galleon where the sails are the Getsen flag, that yellow don't step on me snake. And the caption was, libertarian pilgrims head to Argentina in search of better life. And then the other one that I thought was really funny was a billion Argentinians dead moments after libertarian elected. It was this very like, you know, the entire civilization is billion Argentinians dead. It was very funny. Good job, Babylon Bee.
I think the guy's got a real mutton chop game. You know, he's got wild side.
Hey, he was in a band, dude.
Yeah.
He's a character. He loves his dog. You gotta give him that.
Spirits Are High writes, over the weekend, McAllen broke their own previous record, selling at auction a single bottle of their 1926 Scotch for $2.7 million. Question for all three, what's the oldest, rarest, and or more expensive wine or spirit you've ever consumed, and what was it like?
I had a really old Scotch one time, but I don't remember how old it was. However, I remember a wonderful experience I had when I was maybe 23. I was living in England and I went up to York for the Viking Festival. And I was walking back from the Viking Festival with this ridiculous plastic, anachronistic, incorrect Viking hat. And this older British couple behind me went, "We like your hat." And I went, "Thank you." And they went, "My God, you're an American." And I went, "I am. I'm from Oklahoma." And they went, "Would you like to come back to our place for whiskey?" And I went, "Yes." And so I just hung out with these two 60-something-year-old British people. It was wonderful. They took out their family Bible that was from like 1800 or 1700 to show it to me. They gave me tea, like ridiculous tea that is like harvested in China with silver scissors by virgins or something like that. And then they topped it off with this whiskey that doesn't exist anymore. That was, it had been part of a distillery that doesn't exist. They happen to have a bottle of it. I don't remember what the age was, but I know that it was fairly rare. I don't remember anything about how it tasted, but I remember the experience and how wonderful it was and what a wonderful pretext it was to meet these lovely people from York.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. My uncle gave me a good Scotch, but I don't give a shit enough to like know anything about it. But the only thing that I remember about it is it didn't make me go like, you know, like how like bad liquor just sucks all the moisture out of your mouth. It didn't do that. And he said, like, that's really the difference. Like, it's just a less painful way to ingest your poison. And I was like, oh, okay, like, this is good. But I didn't write down the label or whatever it was. I can appreciate it because that's also why I will pay more to take like a Patron shot as opposed to Jose Cuervo. Like, it's the better ones just hurt less.
Yeah, I can't remember like Heaton the exact brand of it, but it had to be in the whiskey vault at the Wizard Academy. There's, you know, it's just, it's such a blur. They go through all this. Oh, well, this is that. And then like, I seem to remember at some point there was like in hushed tones, cause we were on a private, you know, tour of it, that in hushed tones, it was like, whoa, this is very, very important. And then I drank it. And like, Jen, I just do not have the palate to understand whether or not it was, you know, the best or the worst or whatever.
Yeah. I feel the same way about wine tasting, where every time I go and they're like, sniff it. And I'm like, okay, I don't get it. And I've been wine tasting so many times. I'm just like, I don't appreciate this. I just want to drink the whole thing and get drunk.
I've only been invited to one wine tasting. It was a blast. There's this lovely man that's a listener of my show and likes some of the other work I do. And he does like an annual wine tasting event at the French Embassy in Washington, D.C. And he was like, hey, do you want to come out? Like, I'd comp your ticket. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be in D.C. anyway. I've never been to a wine tasting. I think they're hilarious. Like, it was fun. But they're hilarious because you're literally sipping wine and then going, bah, and spilling it into a bucket. It's the funniest damn thing. Like if you went, hey, do you want to hang out with people in suits? You're going to taste stuff and then belch it into a silver lunch pail. And then at the end, you decide which one you want to drink. Like I think the whole concept is hilarious of a wine tasting. I enjoyed it. Great time. But they're really funny.
They were like one of the funniest after parties that I have ever been to was around the corner from where we used to live in Oakland, and people should visit it. Bay Grape is this amazing wine place, but it's two people that have been in the wine. They're a young couple. They've been in the wine industry forever. And so we're hanging out there on a Sunday night and the owners are like, hey, just hang out. We're going to get rid of everybody else. We're going to lock the door. But we had a bunch of friends coming in. You guys are free. Feel free to hang out. We're like, cool. So we stay there. Then all of a sudden, Snoop Doggy Dogg's Doggy Style starts getting played.
I thought Snoop walked in.
A bunch of, well, people start smoking weed, but then it's just a bunch of sommeliers that are doing exactly that, Heaton. They're just like super fast swirling in, like smelling it, taking one sip and then spitting it into a jug. It was the weirdest. It was the most like highbrow, lowbrow. It was like immediately every party I was at in high school and a sommelier class at the exact same time. But yeah, wine culture is eminently fascinating to me.
Yeah. Remember that movie Sideways? And people are like, oh, it's brilliant. And I couldn't have hated a movie more.
I didn't like anyone in it. I know that the wine people hated it for a while because it made Pinot like preeminent.
Yes.
Like, but I never saw it. I don't know. That's one with Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti, yeah. Thomas Hayden Church. Yeah.
I mean, unless you're a wine sniffer, you're just not going to get the feels.
Okay.
And well, I mean, it does make, it's not exactly a sympathetic portrait of wine snobs. Paul Giamatti is a pretty insufferable character. You sure Thomas hasn't changed, right? Research shows that most Supreme Court justices' ideology shifts gradually over time. So perhaps Justice Thomas's lack of change is actually evidence that he is maintaining an ideology that's preferred by billionaires like his sugar daddy, Harlan Crowe.
Research proves that, huh? The science says, you know what? I'm going to grab one of my colleagues' comments from earlier when Jen said, please include citations. Please include citations for that. I will remind everybody that the fights that typically occur within the Supreme Court are not whether you're conservative or progressive. It's about jurisprudential interpretation. I think the fact that somebody's consistent is probably not evidence that they are somehow being manipulated. The reason that I tend to stick up for Clarence Thomas, because I don't even know if I'm an originalist. I have my own weird cobbled together jurisprudential model, and I don't know quite where it would sit. What I do think happens with Clarence Thomas a lot is he's a Republican appointee that votes for the originalists, and he's black, and that drives a bunch of people batshit crazy. And I think it's unfair. I think that if we want to be scrutinous to all of the justices, that's good. I think a lot of the time Clarence Thomas gets picked on in particular because he's bucking a narrative that's very convenient to one of the two parties. And I, you know what, the stuff that we brought up about the appearance of corruption or the appearance of quid quo pro is very important. And the Supreme Court itself has ruled on those exact considerations when it comes to campaign finance law. And it's a germane conversation to have about the Supreme Court. But the idea that Thomas himself is a stooge and things like that, I think this is part of a tired old narrative that this doesn't fit a broader narrative.
Check your SCOTUS privilege, writes. It's a total of 9 people on the entire planet that are placed in a position of incredible power, respect, and authority. I'm fine with leveraging certain responsibilities that would otherwise be far overreaching if applied to all public servants.
Amen.
So that was, yeah. And you didn't build that, writes. I tend to side with Jen on the SCOTUS ethics issue. I started laughing when Heaton brought up the RV travel that Thomas does. He didn't pay for that RV. The Senate investigated and proved it. So at the heart of that was a loan that Thomas's friend gave him, and it is disputed, although the Senate believes that Thomas did not fully pay back that loan, that the agreement on the loan was 5 years of interest only payments, which was something that the article made very, very clear. No bank would give, which doy. But they were old friends who had come up together, and one of them made money. The other was Clarence Thomas. And so that is, another one of the gifts that have been brought up and investigated by the Senate. So there we go.
RVs are expensive, man. I looked at $250,000
RV. It's apparently one of the RVs that people usually buy for like tours and stuff like that.
It's like one of those big bus kinds, and like you can legit live in there. It can be a one to two bedroom. Good size, especially if you have those pull out deals. Mm-hmm. Like they can be really big.
Let's get to the Andrew Heaton sports question of the week.
Yes.
After 127 years, the Civil War will end. While many people say it's a good thing and a sign of progress, is it really worth losing a part of our culture? Hashtag no Big Ten. Heaton.
I have never felt more betrayed in my life than when the Big Ten came off of my man Harbaugh. Harbaugh is one of the greatest sportsmen of our time. He is the Abraham Lincoln of football.
Yeah.
And the fact that the big team would demonize this poor guy is something that's broken my heart. I hope
we're talking about the Civil War.
Huh?
We're talking about the Civil War. What do you think about the Civil War going away?
Between Big Ten.
No.
And but it's in football.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right, hold on. Let me try this again.
Yeah.
Which are the teams in Michigan?
Get out of Michigan. You're thinking too much about Michigan. Get out of Michigan. It's not in the Big Ten. It is. Right. Okay. In fact, I will tell you, it is in Oregon. It involves Oregon.
Okay. Oh, I got it. Listen, it's weird whenever professional football teams merge, but I think the rancor that has existed between the professional teams of Oregon has gone on too long and too hard, and too many lives have been lost. And if we can have one united Oregon again, can't we all get along as a people here in the United States? I think it's a good thing. I am for that conflict finally resolving.
Coming to an end. So the Civil War is the annual game played between Oregon and Oregon State. And because of the realignment of the what was once the Pac-12, God knows what it is now, but television rights has fucked up all of college football. Now they will no longer be in the same conference. So they're not going to play every year.
You misled me by poorly phrasing that question, listener and Justin. Mm-hmm. Let me clarify my position.
Yeah.
I am adamant that Oregon State and Oregon merge teams. I believe that that is the future of Oregon and the future of our country, and they should not be ripped asunder by paltry television rights. Rather, they should be forced to combine into a super team and finally take down the hated state of Washington.
MMA arc Wayne Mullins writes, Mark Wayne Mullins was a former MMA fighter. That fight would have been good. They were too.
I think it would have been over pretty quick.
By who? Who do you think would have won?
Mark Wayne Mullins.
You think so?
Yeah, I don't think that squish on the other side of the table was going to be a former MMA fighter.
The other dude was sitting down, so I don't know what the actual tale of the tape would be for either of them. But he was a mouthy masshole. The other guy,
he was, and he just had them. I'm going to say he looks like someone who sits down a lot.
Man, I need to do some research on, because like Mullins is from my home state and I know very little about him. I didn't know he was a former MMA fighter. I got to look into this guy. I don't have an opinion yet.
All right. Ozempic. Wizard of Ozempic writes, I have diabetes and Ozempic has been a godsend. Unfortunately, due to drug shortages, I have missed doses here and there while waiting on my pharmacy to get back in stock. The effects are noticeable. My fasting blood sugar is 110 with 2 milligrams Ozempic, 130 with 1 milligram, and 150 after a missed week. It's far from the danger area, but I'm selfishly worried that someone trying to shed an extra 5 pounds may be literally taking days or weeks off the end of my life. Hashtag go big 10.
That is not selfish at all. You're exactly who that medication is for. And I think it is shitty that people that don't need it in the way you do are taking it for vanity reasons. I feel bad for you. And I don't think you should beat yourself up for those feelings at all. I would feel the exact same way.
Ozempic drugs silence the voices that make poor eating decisions, writes, but they don't kill the voices. It doesn't make them go away, never to return. It muzzles them and keeps them in the background where they eventually do push-ups and get stronger. Once the medicine is gone, those voices return with a vengeance. Now, I know a doctor who said that her patients who have used Ozempic, but have done the work and done 20 minutes of exercise a day, counseling and meditation on their lifestyle and eating choices have been able to come off it fine. But the percentage that doesn't do the work, the doctor has described life becoming a living hell for them. Intrusive thoughts driving rapid weight gain, leading to crippling depression and a downward spiral. So just a from the inside on what Ozempic does and does not.
I mean, it makes so much sense to me as someone with, you know, eating issues that a lot of it is emotional. And if you're not willing to work on that part of it, there is no miracle for you. Like, you've got to do the work.
It feels like a lot of the same conversations that we had about like the lap band surgery and stuff throughout the 90s and the 2000s, where it's like, yeah, guess what? It will reduce your ability to eat. But unless you are putting in the work to diet and exercise and do stuff like that, then you're just going to bust right through it. It doesn't matter how much you staple your stomach. It's just going to expand again.
Exactly.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Will Satterberg is not going to edit this episode because he is going to be eating Thanksgiving, but I'm going to go ahead.
Lame.
And say, I know.
Selfish.
But he did work with myself and Brian Brushwood on a surprise 2-part episode of World's Greatest Con, available right now for everybody who is driving around this holiday season. It is all about Walt Disney's dream of Epcot. Not the thing that you go see now, not the binge drinking World's Fair exhibition. No, Epcot, the experimental prototype city of tomorrow, which he hoped through authoritarian control would defeat communism. All the skullduggery that went in to getting all that land around here in Orlando, by far the only reason why I got a direct flight from Frankfurt to Orlando is because of Walt Disney's deal, a deal that remained controversial 50 some odd years after it was made. This is the Reedy Creek Improvement District that DeSantis pulled back. So go ahead. The origin story on all that. World's Greatest Con. Jen, what's on the dish?
Well, I feel like this episode was already a preview. It is every detail about the Santos, not only ethics investigation, but also the indictments, because there was a superseding in that one too. And then I went deep on the Menendez indictments because there was the follow-up one about the foreign agent. But I also, my assistant and I, we found some other things, just kind of looked into like, what has he done as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I found some things that it sure looks like he was doing some favors to Egypt to me. So, if you want to know those details, they're fascinating. Both of those cases were fascinating. Yeah. And that is ready for you for your Thanksgiving travels.
Perfect.
I am literally leaving from here to travel to Oklahoma, and I will listen to both of these programs. They both sound fascinating. Yeah. Ah, yay. On the political orphanage, having done 2 weeks of economics-related stuff, we're going back to bread and butter. We're going to nuclear deterrence. If you want to learn about how nuclear deterrence works, I have a listener of my show that is waist deep in it to the point where I could not reveal where he works and what he does. Let me assure you, he very much knows what he's talking about. That is on the political orphanage. Meanwhile, my TV show, Adults Are Talking with Andrew Heaton, has aired.
George Santos. Anyway, go ahead.
George Santos. Adults Are Talking with Andrew Heaton, which you can find on YouTube and Twitter, has aired episode number 2, which is very funny and I think funnier than the first episode. So don't watch it while you're driving your car. Watch it when you get to your destination. Adults Are Talking with Andrew Heaton.
Oh, I love that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To see it. All right. That'll wrap it up for us. For Jen Rainey and Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. A reminder, friends, that we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.